Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest Lava, Thunder, and Screaming Goats edition. It's Wednesday, July 12th, 2022. On today's show, Thor, Love and Thunder. It's the fourth solo venture for the Norse god, as reinterpreted by Marvel Studios. As always, this stars Chris Hemsworth as the hammer-wielding deity, and it returns Natalie Portman as with Ragnarok. This one is directed by Taika Waititi. And then Fire of Love is a documentary feature about a legendary pair of volcano chasers, the Crafts. Katya and Maurice were a married couple who traveled the globe over to film active volcanoes up close. This extraordinary film, really, really remarkable film, is directed and co-written by Sarah Dosa. And finally, the streaming services, they've proliferated and matured very quickly over the last few years. A ton of competition now in that space. We discuss which one we like best, worst, and in between, the fate of that business as well. Joining me today is Jamelle Bouie, of course, the political columnist for The New York Times, among many other things. Hey, Jamelle, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me back.
It's awesome. 2 weeks in a row is quite a treat. And of course, Dana Stevens, every week in a row is a treat, the film critic for Slate.com. Hey, Dana.
Hello, hello.
All right, well, I'm sorry to report due to a scheduling conflict, I was not able to see Thor, Love and Thunder. So I will drop out for the first segment and hand the microphone over to Dana, and my place will be taken by David Sims, the terrific film critic of The Atlantic. Take it away, Dana.
Thor, Love and Thunder is the fourth Marvel movie to focus on the Nordic god slash superhero played by Chris Hemsworth. It's also the first time ever a Marvel hero has gotten four consecutive solo movies. And in the words of our guest for this segment, film critic David Sims, it is the 20 bajillionth movie to come out of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Like the last solo Thor film, Thor Ragnarok, in 2017, Love and Thunder was directed by Taika Waititi, the New Zealand-born comedian, actor, and filmmaker who, in the years since Ragnarok came out, has won a Best Adapted Screenplay Oscar and has become a ubiquitous presence on the Marvel, Disney, Pixar scene. When Thor Ragnarok came out back in 2017, it was hailed as a really fresh comedic voice in the cinematic universe of Marvel. We're going to talk about whether Waititi's second Marvel venture lives up to those standards in a moment. We're going to kick off, first of all, with a little sound clip from Thor Love and Thunder. In this scene, you will hear Hemsworth as Thor, Tessa Thompson as Valkyrie, another as Guardian, goddess heroine, and Natalie Portman as Dr. Jane Foster, the astrophysicist who is the former Earth girlfriend of Thor. The three of them are discussing entering the realm of shadows, a colorless netherworld where they're about to seek the film's villain, who we'll talk more about later.
They're in the shadow realm.
How'd you know?
The atmosphere there has a darkness like no other. It's as if color fears to tread. It's unmistakable.
Well, then, if it's color we need, let's bring the rainbow.
Bring the rainbow? Is that a catchphrase or something?
She's only been a Thor for a minute. I mean, saving lives, she's quite good at, but the rest of it, she needs work.
How many catchphrases have there been?
A lot.
Yep. Jump the gun.
Hang on. He moves through shadows and he's going to the shadow realm. It seems like that's where he's going to be the most powerful.
You're right. We can't just go marching in there. It could be a trap.
Are you thinking what I think you're thinking?
I'm thinking it.
What are we thinking?
Thinking what?
I'm thinking it too.
Omnipotent city.
Omnipotent city, they say at the end. So they're headed off to Omnipotent City, the realm of the gods. Joining us for this segment, because Steve was not able to make it to the theater to see Thor, is David Sims, film critic for The Atlantic, host of the Blank Check podcast, and friend of our podcast. Hi, David.
Hi, Dana. Thank you for having me.
I'm really glad to have you on this one, David, because in your review in particular of Thor, Love and Thunder, you raise a question that goes beyond this movie. You ask whether it's time to start ridding the world of superheroes the way that this movie, as we'll get into, thinks about what it would be to rid the universe of gods. In addition to telling me what you think of Thor, Love and Thunder, I want to hear about how you are feeling about the Marvel Cinematic Universe as we slog our way through phase four of their output.
I mean, for one, I think it's a little a little alarming that we all can throw around terms like phase four, which is a term I know and you know, and it's like, what does that even mean at this point? Like, what phase four of how many phases? Like, what is the meaning of phase four? And like, as far as I can tell, phase four is this sort of catch-all for like everything that Marvel's produced since Avengers Endgame, which offered, you know, something of a real conclusion for some of its characters, right? And since then, it's been a lot of like trying stuff out and giving maybe new characters a little room to shine and doing television shows and then throwing things out like Thor, Love and Thunder, that's a sequel we ostensibly would be excited for, right? Because like you said, Ragnarok was this sort of charming hit and sort of gave a new angle to the character, and Taika Waititi brought like, you know, some sort of unexpected humor to the franchise and all that. And so everything about that feels eminently logical, doing another one. And yet it's watching the film and watching a lot of these recent Marvel movies, and I like plenty of Marvel movies, you just have this sense of everyone is kind of looking around waiting for the next big thing or the next purpose, like for whatever this saga, where are we headed? Like, where is the road going? I don't have much of a sense of that anymore, of big stakes.
I mean, there I'm going to throw to Jamel, because I know that Jamel responded very negatively to this movie. I think your tweet about it was more like bore Love and Thunder. So Jamel, you are also probably the biggest comic book fan among us, and you were very down on this movie. I, on the other hand, was somewhat of a critical outlier in finding it a trifle but mildly amusing. So I want to hear why it's bore Love and Thunder for you.
I just found the whole thing exhausting. Even that clip just bummed me out, because it's sort of, you know, there doesn't need to be any like compelling reasons beyond, I guess, the plot needs to take us to this new place for why they're going. And there's no like, you know, there's no attempt at unpack what this place even is. It's just like, oh, of course there's this big city where all the gods live. We're going to go there now. And just sort of that whole energy of kind of like, you know, we're not going to bother trying to, you know, even attempt to ground anything in the characters or the story or any larger story that's being told, not in terms of plot points, but in terms of like thematic concerns, which are like non-existent. And I don't need much on that point. I just need like a little something. It's all sort of, I don't know, I feel this movie in particular, and I think it's been true, as David said, there's a lot of the recent Marvel movies just felt sort of like half-hearted and tossed together. The one thing in the whole film that I thought was worthwhile was Christian Bale's performance as Gore, the God Killer. And there was like not enough of that. It's like the one really good thing there wasn't very much of. And all the stuff that is, you know, almost kind of paint by numbers, it's everywhere.
I gave this movie a mildly positive review, and I will give you some of the reasons. For one thing, as you just said, Jamel, Christian Bale, who's an unusually good actor to put in the role of a Marvel villain and an unusually big name, is great as Gore the God Butcher. I think it's one of the best Marvel villains I can remember. I mean, he's given this pre-credit sequence where you see his motivation for becoming a God Killer, and that's exactly what he is, someone who goes through the universe trying to slaughter all deities. And not only is his performance genuinely moving and his motivation genuinely understandable and identifiable, but he's scary. He's legitimately scary every time he comes on the scene, which I agree is too little. So that's one thing in its favor. Secondly, this movie is short. It comes in at just under 2 hours. I think it's a minute under 2 hours. And that in itself, the lack of bloat, is an argument on its behalf. And it doesn't take itself too seriously. I mean, there's some heavy stuff, including in the villain story and in Jane's story. But this movie actually did, and maybe this will make you guys not respect my sense of humor anymore, but it made me laugh out loud several times, usually at Chris Hemsworth's just kind of doofus jock hero character. But yeah, there were a few visual jokes. There were even some camera jokes that made me laugh. I thought that the screaming goats that pulled the Viking ship through space, which is their vessel they travel in, were really silly and funny. And I think I went in with, you know, lowered expectations, thinking I'm just going to try to appreciate this movie for what it is and not think about how Marvel movies are destroying cinema. And I kind of enjoyed it.
I laughed plenty at this film. I think, like, I'm an easy laugh, to be fair. I'll laugh at anything. But like, the goats are funny. There's plenty of like Taika's humor that'll get sort of like an easy laugh out of me. But I just find that he used to be better, or certainly many times in his career has been better at sort of weaving the kind of tossed off humor stuff with something more emotional, right? And this movie has emotional plot lines, like you mentioned. Like, it's got, he's trying to do the trick he pulled with like Hunt for the Wilder People or Jojo Rabbit or whatever, you know. And instead, it just felt like he's kind of just whooshing from thing to thing and not sure what to stick to. Like, it all felt undercooked.
I mean, Dana, you mentioned that this is a little unusual, that it's the fourth solo movie for a Marvel character, which hasn't happened before. You know, I mean, maybe you can think of, you know, one of the team movies as a solo movie for Iron Man or whatever, but this is officially the first fourth solo movie for a Marvel character. And that's a little tough because the Thor character, over the course of three solo movies and four Avengers movies and so on and so forth, has sort of had a character arc, has developed a character arc, has come to a place. And so maybe instead of having a movie trying to advance Thor's character a bit further, and there really isn't that much more advancing to do, maybe you do focus on someone else in the film, in the world. In a movie that was like much more about gore and sort of much more centered on Gore's journey, might have been kind of interesting. It might have given everyone something to do, might have provided an anchor for the script for all the characters to kind of be connected to. But as it stands, you have a character, Thor, who has developed plenty, and there's just not that much left to do with him.
Yeah, see, that's where I wanted to take the conversation next, in a way, is beyond this movie and sort of into whether the MCU, because I know that I felt, not so much after seeing this movie, but after reviewing it and then just seeing the wave of critical response and fan response, that I just feel so over the entire Marvel shtick. And I feel sort of like asking my editor, can I just beg off reviewing Marvel movies for the upcoming future? Because there keep being these exceptions where I think, oh, well, this one's directed by Chloe Zhao, so maybe this one will have something new and interesting to say about it, right? Or, oh, Taika Waititi is making another Thor movie, and this is going to be something fresh and new. And it seems like, I don't know that you can lay it at the feet of these directors, you know? I mean, Marvel is more and more interested in getting these name brand directors to try to kind of put their imprimatur on the product, but ultimately it is still a Marvel product and there's only so much you can do with it. And I think that's really true as a critic as well. I really feel like there's an orthodoxy, not just the orthodoxy of fandom, but a critical orthodoxy too around these movies. And it's just really hard to encounter them as individual experiences rather than as, you know, part of this mass production line.
There's a real, as much as not every Marvel movie is perfect, certainly, there's a real feat to what they pulled off in that run from Iron Man to Avengers Endgame, which is what, about 10, 11 years, where the fact that any of that makes sense, that there's a sort of big narrative through line to those 20 movies, and it ends in this way that brings everybody together and feels somewhat satisfying. You know, that nothing has happened like that in movies before. So, you know, I doff my hat. It's good. I like Marvel movies just fine. Like, I just get this sense now that there is this prestige associated with Marvel, as much as people like to razz them. They are, you know, guaranteed big hit movies. They are a way to plant a foothold as a filmmaker, right? And maybe get enough clout that you can go off and make passion projects afterwards. But now I feel like they just exist for the sake of existing. And that's a problem if you're going to pump three or four out a year on top of these freaking TV shows that are feeling, you know, vaguely relevant at best. So I imagine, I don't think people like Kevin Feige, who runs this whole operation, are stupid. Like, I do imagine there's a longer game they're playing, and sort of a hope to kind of start bringing some threads together and, you know, add some coherence. But my whole take in my review, where I'm saying, you know, the Gore the God Butcher thing, he is sick and tired of these heroes who are kind of just like guffawing and like goofing around and like not really interested in being superheroes. And that's sort of the vibe of some of these recent movies. Like, there's not a lot of like straightforward daring do happening right now. So it is easy to identify with Gore just wanting to swing a big axe around, a big sword, whatever it is he's got.
The necro sword, David. The necro sword,
of course. And, you know, I'm a big comic book nerd. I think Jamel knows that. Like, I know everything that this is pulling from. Like, I love the Jason Aaron run on Thor that this is sort of inspired by. And I just don't think the movie has really been able to drill down to the, like, you know, big emotional storytelling that it's capable of.
I completely agree with that. And but I do think there's something to be said for having people not just behind the camera, but kind of in the whole process, who don't have all that much attachment to these things and are willing to kind of experiment with them. Because I think what the MCU is missing is it's such a streamlined factory at this point that there's no real sense that these characters or these worlds are without boundaries. We know what the boundaries are. They're very clear. And, you know, the last superhero movie I watched before this was Matt Reeves' new Batman movie. And what I kind of just like about that movie is it sort of attempts to do something different with the character, play around with the world a bit more, give you something a little new that you haven't seen before. In terms of a very well-worn property. And I just don't think there's much of that with the Marvel movies. And it's when you add to some aesthetic things about them that they all kind of look drab. I think this one especially looked like it was shot on a parking lot. it kind of adds up to something very disappointing. And for me, at least, it felt, and I said this on Twitter, it felt like eating, you know, like a cold McRib. Just sort of like far less than the sum of its parts at that point. And the sum of its parts weren't even that great to begin with.
Yeah, the parking lot is not a joke, Jamel. I think I'm sure you guys saw that interview where Natalie Portman actually talked about a scene which she described as visually stunning, maybe for PR purposes, and that she remembered being on a parking lot of Best Buy while they were shooting this green screen moment. All right, well, the movie is Thor: Love and Thunder. It's in theaters only right now, but no doubt coming to streaming pretty soon. Let us know what you thought of the movie and of the Marvel Cinematic Universe and of this segment at culturefest@slate.com. All right, moving on.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on all your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
All right, now is the moment in our podcast when we discuss business. Dana, what do you have?
Our only item of business today, Steve, is to tell you about today's Slate Plus segment. This week, we will answer a question from a listener named Ezra, who wrote in wanting to know which movie cliches we would retire if we could. This is a really good question. He gave a couple examples of his cliches that he would retire, which we'll tell you about when we get to that segment. But we have our own thoughts as well, so we are really excited to take on Ezra's question. If you're a Slate Plus member, you will hear that segment at the end of this show. And if you're not a Slate Plus member, as you know, you can sign up today at slate.com/cultureplus. When you're a member, you get ad-free podcasts. You get bonus content like that segment I just described, which exists on lots of other shows as well. And you'll get unlimited access to all of the great writing on Slate.com. You will never hit a paywall when you're a member of Slate Plus. Also, of course, you'll be supporting us, our work, our podcast, the writing and the podcasting of all of our brilliant colleagues. These memberships matter a lot for Slate. So please sign up today at slate.com/cultureplus. Once again, that's slate.com/cultureplus. Okay, back to the show.
Katya and Maurice met as young students and bonded over a mutual and very intense fascination with volcanoes. Each became a scientist, she a geochemist, he a geologist. They got married, and together they spent the rest of their lives chasing active volcanoes the globe over. To support themselves, they created scores of books and films and made dozens upon dozens of actually very charming TV appearances in their native France and elsewhere. These add up to an astonishing archive, which has now been sorted through and cut into a 90-minute documentary, Fire of Love. As moving as the up-close images of the exploding Earth are, molten and exploding Earth, it's really amazing. Trust me. This wild, trippy symphony is as much about time, human consciousness, and love as it is about its ostensible subject, volcanoes. This film is directed by Sarah Dosa. As I think I said, Katya and Maurice were French. Much of the film is subtitled, but it is narrated in English beautifully by Miranda July. In the following clip, you'll hear her talking about what drives Katya and Maurice to explore such perilous terrain.
Katya and Maurice are after the strange alchemy of elements, the combination of mineral, heat, gas, and time that incites an eruption. What is it, they ask, that makes the Earth's heart beat? Its blood flow. They study, examine, and question. Katya and Maurice begin to learn the secrets of the planet that few others know. Understanding is love's other name.
Jamel, I went into this not knowing what to expect. I found myself completely riveted, very taken with it. What'd you make of this movie?
I had the exact same experience. I just knew that this is a movie about volcanoes, and that was the extent of my knowledge. And by the end of it, I was sort of enwrapped with the couple, sort of really taken with their story and their journey, heartbroken at how it ended, but just sort of really kind of really amazed with the film. I watched it with my wife. We both were just sort of entranced for 90 minutes. I thought it was a really beautiful film.
Yeah, I'd be shocked if the three of us weren't pounding the table on this, Dana. Am I right in that regard? What'd you think of Fire of Love?
I mean, I am certainly pounding the table that it's a must-see documentary. The actual story of the couple themselves, who are just unbelievably telegenic and charming, and then the over 200 hours of footage of volcanoes that they made together over, I guess, about 20 years, that's been edited down into this just visually absolutely stunning. Steve, you stole a word that I was going to use, which is trippy. It's a very psychedelic experience to watch this. I made a point of going to the theater to watch it, and if I'm going to pound the table for anything, it's seeing this movie in a movie theater, because on a big screen, just these kind of endless shots of flowing rivers of magma and, you know, crazy rock formations and, I don't know, just shots from a plane of huge areas of devastation. It's just the sense of geologic scale is wonderfully conveyed in this movie. However, my table pounding ceases for a moment when it comes to some of the framing of this material. There were some moments, and I saw this with my husband, who also loved it. We were very happy that we went to see it in the theater. It's a great date movie because there's tons to talk about afterwards. It's wildly romantic. It's, you know, huge visual spectacle. But both of us had almost identical reservations about some of the way the material was framed, which had more to do with the narration, which we found occasionally a bit overwritten. There were some moments when, and I think we felt it in the exact same moments, where a beautiful point would be made in the narration that Miranda July is reading, which is partly written by Sarah Dosa, along with the two editors who helped co-write it and a fourth writer. And then there would just be this moment of lily gilding where the beautiful observation would be followed by an obvious observation that we already got from the visual material itself. These are small critiques, to be sure, but there were moments when I felt like I wish someone was handling this with a little bit of a lighter touch. There were also, and these were very minimal, but because they were so minimal, I don't know why they had to be there at all. There were these moments of animation where, you know, a little bit of Katya and Maurice's story, for example, when they met in Alsace, where they're both from, is there's no visuals for that, right? They weren't filming their lives yet, and so it's there's a bit of animation inserted. And that animation was just kind of tacky. And both of us came out sort of saying, this story is already so unbelievably romantic. The idea that you would animate it and then have the little animated cutouts that represent the couple have little twinkling hearts in the middle of their bodies is just kind of like tacky. So, I mean, those are small things, but put it this way. Werner Herzog has also made a movie about this same material, which is kind of surprising in the same year. And I would love an oral history of how those two docs happened at the same time. His documentary hasn't opened yet, but I believe it's opened abroad in some countries and it might be available streaming. I'm going to look into this because I really want to see Herzog in the same material. But this is nothing against Sarah Dosa. I think she did a brilliant job of presenting this story. But I would be very curious to see what Herzog does with it, because I think the same material could have been presented in a different way I might have preferred.
I loved this movie. I mean, maybe there were a couple of gilded lily petals along the way, but the animation being one in particular. I actually thought another prominent use of animation in the movie really worked for me. It was when describing, and the film tells you this immediately, it's not a spoiler, but they die chasing a volcano, and the moment of their separation when a kind of, to use a trite word, button is placed on this sublime relationship that they've had both with one another and the volcanoes they've chased and documented. I actually thought that was quite poetic and deft. I was surprised, first of all, pleasantly surprised by how economical the movie was. It comes in at about 90 minutes. And secondly, by how much the lily was just allowed to sort of flutter in the breeze. I thought a lot of it was very poetic and relatively simple. I appreciated the attempt to use language to get at something more than just what the images were. I thought what was really interesting, Jamel, is how much you get to know this couple and yet how much, in a way, you don't, in some sense. There's such a set of strange contradictions. On the one hand, sort of classic world-averse nerds who lose themselves in an obsession in order to avoid humanity in general, right? And because they both share that, they're obviously deeply, deeply connected to one another. At the same time, very media savvy. Almost him, especially Maurice, is something of a showboat. They knew how to play to the camera, their own cameras, and to the television camera, in a sense. And that kept stimulating in a good way, but I had more curiosity than could be satisfied by apparently this archive.
Yes. So there's a point in the film, and I'll use this as an opportunity as like a quick parenthetical to say that, you know, the footage is their footage, the photographs are their photographs. And while, you know, it seems like it would be the easy thing to take pictures of big majestic or photograph big majestic things and have kind of, you know, like, oh, obviously it's going to look good. It's clear from the material that they were very, very talented photographers and videographers. And that's sort of like they had not just sharp eyes, but like a sense of visual storytelling. And there's a part in the documentary where the narrator, whose name I forget, notes that, you know, because they have all this footage, you can sort of see them figure out or think through, well, what is the best way to visually present this thing? You know, what is the best way to communicate a particular feeling or emotion using the camera? And, you know, to this point of the couple being somewhat enigmatic, that scene sort of suggests it kind of it takes away a little bit from the love story and suggests that there's something much more complex happening with them and with how they perceive themselves and they think about their work. I feel like there something similar happens towards the beginning where, you know, it's after they've been married and there's a quick note that they decide not to have children, which is sort of that's a striking decision, especially for the time, the late 60s in France. And so they're like their inner lives, like for as much as the movie is about the inner lives actually are not all that apparent in the film. And I don't think it's a bad thing. I think it's interesting. I think it makes them sort of like even more compelling to kind of look at and watch. But it is just an interesting thing. We have all this footage. We have all this, you know, all these words, all this stuff that is comes from the interior, but doesn't reveal as much as you think it might.
Yeah, I mean, at one point, there's this very sly, uncharacteristic part of the voiceover script where the narrator says, over time, they got good at playing themselves, right? Which suddenly kind of undercuts this sort of naked relationship they had with the terrestrial sublime. And all of a sudden, they seem kind of a little show busy it's not entirely the wrong word, but it's maybe a little bit of a low blow. But, you know, Maurice is a showboater, right? He takes this little inflatable dinghy that he makes a point of telling a TV host he bought at a, you know, Paris flea market. It's a, you know, cheap little rubber dinghy or whatever, and he inflatable dinghy takes it out on a lake of sulfuric acid, right? Which, of course, they capture. Not only that he's doing this, which is a preposterous risk, he spends 3 hours out there trying to paddle back to shore as his own, you know, materials are getting eaten through by the acid. They also, there are shots of Katya, pacing worriedly on the shore. And so they occupied a kind of odd couple where he was the, you know, a bit of a clown and she was the deeply serious, more scientific of the two. Ostensibly, they played these roles in a kind of self-consciously theatrical way. How did that make you feel about them in the movie, Dan? Was it sort of somewhat distrustful or more intrigued than the movie could address directly?
Yeah, I don't think that made me distrustful of them, but it humanized them as characters and gave you more of a glimpse into their... It didn't heroicize them, let's say.
Yeah.
Yes, they were constructing something, but that doesn't mean that their lives were not authentically dangerous and that the risks they took were not authentically insane. So those moments in the documentary, to me, strengthened it. And I wish that we had gotten a bit more of a glimpse into their non-volcanic lives. I mean, like you say, Steve, you get the impression that their true lives were lived in these moments that they were camping out in volcanoes, filming things or waiting for things to happen so they could film them. But they also spent some time back in France producing the TV shows and the books that allowed them to keep on funding their research. And I wish we had known a bit more about that. I suppose this would be something that a more conventional documentary would do, but I would have loved an interview or two with people who knew them, people who worked with them. There's somebody who cited a few times who used to go and film with them a lot, who sometimes pulled them out of danger at the last minute. And I would have loved to hear an interview with either that person or whatever survivors he has. These are not critiques exactly, but it's that this documentary is so much about a mystery that it guards at its center that it leaves you wanting to go through that archive yourself. You just want to go dig into the crafts, big boxes of, you know, of film and figure it all out on your own.
Right, right.
My viewing partner and I talked about wanting a fiction version of the same thing, not to exactly fill holes in this movie, but just because there's so many moments that it makes you want to imagine what was it like when they camped out, when they set up their tent, when they had the conversation about not having children, you know, when they discovered for the first time that they both wanted to have this insane life of chasing volcanoes. I mean, I would love, it sounds like if the right filmmaker did it, I would absolutely love to see a fiction version of this. And we even had it cast on our way out of the movie. So get this, John C. Reilly as Maurice Kraft.
Oh, yeah,
right?
Obviously.
Perfect.
Yeah.
This kind of big bear of a man, right? Kind of funny, kind of goofy showmanship, etc. And then Tilda Swinton as Katya, this very bird-like, you know, intense and kind of academic woman.
I love it. All right. Well, I think three of us are enthusiastic enough to say, if you haven't, maybe go to the theater and check it out. Definitely do it on a big screen. All right, it's Fire of Love, and it's in theaters now. All right, moving on.
The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true, but shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son George on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. Trust me, you've never seen a mother-son duo like this before. This show is full of wit, scandal, action, and did I mention Julianne Moore? Something this audacious and sexy is as genre-bending as it gets. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you listening right now are probably multitasking. Yep, while you're listening, you're probably also driving, cleaning, exercising, or maybe even grocery shopping. But if you're not some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you can be doing right now: getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So, just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
All right. Well, when I was growing up, advertising was the dominant means of monetizing content. And it gave the illusion, at least to me as a very young person, that everything was free or at least relatively pretty cheap. The collapse of advertising as the dominant business model has turned our world into a subscription-based one, largely. Television is the biggest shocker, again, if you're my age. It went from being ad-saturated, I mean, you just sat there for hours being passively blitzed by 30-second or even minute-long ads. And now it's largely ad-free because, of course, it's dominated by streaming subscription services. Most of the streaming services are in both businesses. They're both content producers and content distributors. It's crazy how uncornered that market was until relatively recently. As I recall, as recently as 3-4 years ago, you could have Amazon Prime, Netflix, Hulu, and maybe you're done at that point. Well, there are a lot more choices now. That means tougher choices and a tougher business model. People are going to start adding new ones, dropping old ones, and it raises a question. Dana, I'll start with you. Which of these do you admire? Which of these do you find disposable? Which annoy you? What do you make of the streaming wars?
I mean, the whole economics of this annoy me, honestly. It just feels like everybody is constantly trying to cut a new hole in your pocket by inventing some streaming service that you suddenly need. And I probably am the only one of the three of us who has not yet cut the cable cord for various reasons, mainly involving sports broadcasts that need to be seen in our home at certain times of year. We still have cable. In addition to a whole bunch of these services, of course, it is my job to talk about media and movies and TV and culture. So to some degree, this is a work expense for me, and I do write off cable and my taxes, but still, it really, really adds up. And at this point, I guess we've also got Apple and Paramount Plus and Disney Plus and HBO Max, and it's just, I don't even want to think about what the toll this is taking on our household budget every month. As for which ones are worth it, I don't know. I mean, I guess it depends on what you want to watch and what matters to you about these services, but a lot of them feel to me like they're trying to add enough value, just enough value to get that extra $5 or $10 a month out of your pocket and not delivering that much beyond that. I mean, there's plenty of these channels that I have basically to watch one thing, you know, Apple TV Plus, I'm hanging on to it because I love Severance. Maybe I'll even get rid of it until Severance comes back again. Paramount Plus. I like watching Star Trek Strange New Worlds, which I actually was thinking about endorsing on today's show. But that's the only thing I watch on that particular channel. So it's seeming more and more like they just want to dangle enough bait to get each user to have that relationship to one show. And then they pad the rest of it out with whatever they pad it out with. I don't know. Obviously, these aren't calculated decisions on these networks' part. They're also trying desperately to figure out what to throw out to survive. But the media landscape right now feels very consumer unfriendly to me, and it just feels like a big running scam. I don't know. What about you guys?
I feel somewhat similarly. I've been kind of gradually paring back streaming services, except for those that I find actually kind of essential, because they just, you know, it's like Amazon Prime, for example. It's sort of like a lot of crap and then a couple shows that you might want to watch. And I'm not sure that's necessarily worth shelling out $10 or $11 a month. I think the services that are worth something are those that provide kind of a big back catalog of actually interesting stuff to watch. So I think HBO Max, you know, I'm not sure the app is put together all that well, but it has this sort of very deep catalog of, you know, Warner Brothers films, Turner Classic Movies, that kind of thing. And I think that's really valuable. I feel like I've boosted Criterion Channel in here before. I'll do it again. Criterion Channel is like absolutely worth the money, because it's not just a deep collection of films of all sorts, but also the company puts a lot of effort into curation and sort of like providing you, the viewer, a structure for what you might want to watch. And that's, I mean, I think that's the kind, if we're thinking about what we'd want streaming services to do, that's the kind of thing I'd like to see more of, not just kind of dropping everything in front of us, but sort of saying, you know, here are things that go together thematically or from the same director or so on and so forth. But then that requires being able to have the kind of big catalog and, you know, access to lots of stuff that most of these services just don't have.
Yeah. I mean, for me, like my hobby horse has always been, you know, the relationship between the business model and the content. I just find that subject fascinating because, you know, Dana, you know this story intimately well, which is, you know, effectively it was an integrated, vertically integrated business, and the studios used to own the theaters. And because you had enormous amounts of risk control built into the model, you could have, you know, splashy budgets, and you had stars under lifelong contracts. And as you move into a free agent world, the risks become huge. The upfront budget costs are so massive relative to the possibility that people just won't like it and watch it, that you have to control risk another way. So what do? They create the blockbuster, and the blockbuster has, using very familiar IP, has huge, reliable, built-in, you know, fan bases that will show up to it's more to re-enter a world often, it seems to me, than to actually enjoy a story that has an element of freshness or surprise to it. And it's the hordes of people who are willing to pay the cost for world re-entry that make it possible to produce, you know, $100 to $200 million budgeted Marvel movies and Star Wars movies and on and on and on. That's a huge detriment to Hollywood that was compensated for by streaming, because it was the other model. It was like being vertically integrated in that you had subscribers. It didn't ultimately matter who watched what on the far end. What mattered was you had subscriber growth. And I think it's fascinating to enter a period of stagnating subscriber growth, and also an embarrassment of riches for consumers. I mean, the golden age of TV really came about because of the subscription model that HBO pioneered and allowed them to become a studio, a super high quality studio and a pioneer in quality TV. What's amazing is how long TV was that good and the competition was relatively limited. And we were talking about a tiny oligopoly of really reliable producers, basically Prime, Netflix, HBO when it was still a cable channel, and then a little bit along the fringes, a couple of others, which you could subscribe to or not subscribe to. But if you wanted to like have a water cooler conversation about TV for several years now, your budget was probably well under $50 a month, as opposed to a cable bill, which got up to $180 or something. And that's really changing now. And it does feel, Jamel, like to me doing the show 3 to 5 years ago, it was low hanging fruit. Every week we could just place our palm out and a nice big juicy ripe, you know, TV show would fall into it that we could talk about. And now the pickings seem much slimmer to me. Is that your experience?
That seems right. I mean, I don't watch a ton of TV. I kind of have largely checked out of it. But as far as I can tell, there's a lot, you know, there's a lot of slop. And this is how I feel about movies, certainly. I think as far as the streaming services and movies go, there is a point at which you might be a little excited to see what kind of movie a streaming service is producing. But these days, it's just sort of, you know, lots of very mediocre things that aren't necessarily worth watching. And it's a struggle to find something that is.
Yeah, Netflix had that moment, right? Netflix had that moment that it was making Marriage Story and, you know, Oscar contending kinds of movies, and it was going to try to move into that space. And I think they have just pretty recently decided that that's not really worth it. And they're just going to continue to churn out more mediocre content and try to get a broader base of subscribers. So I don't know. I mean, I worry about whether or not there's going to be any streamer that's willing to step in and start trying to save the theatrical part of their business.
Yeah. I mean, another way to look at this also is that, you know, in the early growth phase of the subscriber services, rate of growth is more important maybe than, you know, absolute number of eyeballs in some sense. Well, why? Because what you're trying to do is please Wall Street and stimulate a lot of investment capital from Wall Street and investors. And so your market cap may not actually, it reflects a future expectation of how big the company will get with growth. Well, the problem is as it draws in competition, you know, all the early adopters have already signed up. You've already drawn in all of the discerning viewers with, you know, spare cash, and now you're fighting among them. It just changes it changes the content drastically because, you know, you're no longer, you're trying to achieve habitual complacency with a built-in subscriber base that's very hard to grow now because of saturation and maturity of the business model in a field of much more intense competition, as opposed to stimulating discerning early adopters to subscribe to this exciting new thing and demonstrate growth to Wall Street. Jamel, what sometimes occurs to me in moments of exhilaration but also terror is that, you know, a lot of people have argued that the asset economy, sort of asset boom driven economy with Wall Street at its heart, which we've been enjoying is not the right word, but living in for 30, 40 years, may be coming to an end. And in that sense, content was on a bubble. What we were seeing and how good what we were seeing for many years and took for granted was in no small part a consequence of cheap, easy credit, asset bubbles, and these companies' stock prices being mammothly inflated based on an anticipation of, you know, future earnings. And once that comes to an end, it's not only that they stagnate as business models, what we watch is going to become way more banal and risk averse.
No, that sounds right. That sounds very right, that sort of, to the extent that there was a golden age for any of this stuff, it was the result of cheap and easy free-flowing money and no other productive use for it, no force in society trying to find a productive use for it. It maybe isn't an accident, right, that kind of the most the streaming services that seem to be, if you can call any of these things vital, seem to be vital, they're ones that are connected to some kind of business that has like a physical component. You know what I mean? Sort of like it actually produces something, right? Like HBO Max, HBO still, you know, is a cable network that people pay for. And obviously, you know, Warner Brothers is the big studio and so on and so forth. Criterion, you know, their bread and butter is still producing physical, like, you know, restoring films, producing physical disc, and like selling them to people. It might be the case that as the streaming era continues forward, the streaming services that will remain, you know, worthwhile, will be vital, are the ones that are connected to a business that is simply, that is bigger than just trying to juice up subscriber numbers.
Okay. All right. Let's just go around the horn here. Jamel, we'll start with you. Desert Island streaming service. You only have one. Assume that its current level of quality stays constant ad infinitum. What are you taking with you?
I mean, it's going to be Criterion. if I could only have one, that's the one.
That's a great choice. I suspect it's Dana's too.
Yeah. I mean, I almost feel like that's a different animal. I mean, obviously, technically, it is a streaming service, but it's not. It doesn't feel like an aggregator that's trying to kind of get eyeballs in the same way. It feels more like belonging to a library or something like that. Yeah, 100%. It would definitely be Criterion. And in fact, I should be doing that right now. I should be online disconnecting all these other subscriptions, saving lots of money, and watching a lot more good movies.
All right. I'm going to go with the, you know, sort of counterintuitive choice here, which is I'm going to stick with Netflix. And I think we just got spoiled by the 800-pound gorilla that had unbelievable amounts of Wall Street treasure to spend on various content of every kind, like, you know, old sitcoms and, you know, new prestige movies. And they're being judged against a standard appropriate to a couple, 3 years ago, and they didn't have the competition. Even all of that said, I find myself watching Netflix all the time. I like ransacking it for stuff and always find, you know, something in it. And I think some of their new content has been relatively fresh. It's a changed world and they deserve to be graded on that curve. All right. Well, this is one of those ones where, like, the segment really only gets rounded out in our email boxes. We'd love to hear what you guys think about this subject. All right, moving on.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
All right. Well, now is the moment in our podcast when we endorse Dana. What do you have?
Steve, I already mentioned my endorsement in our streaming segment just now. It's Star Trek Strange New Worlds, which is this the series that started earlier this spring on Paramount Plus, and which initially I had no interest in because, as I've talked about before on the show, I mean, it's not even that I'm a purist. I'm just boring and stodgy. The only Star Trek that I've ever really cared about is the original one, the original series from the 60s, which I grew up watching in reruns and which is a huge sort of formative part of my life as a viewer. Just those early memories of the primary colors and weird sparkly props and that whole 60s universe of the first Star Trek. And Strange New Worlds is the first of the many, many now Star Trek spinoff series to have really gone back to that world. It's sort of a prequel to the original Star Trek. It takes place in roughly the same time frame with some of the same characters, including Science Officer Spock and Christopher Pike, who, if you followed the original show, was the very first captain of the Starship Enterprise. He was only in the pilot of Star Trek, and then William Shatner came in as Kirk to replace him. So this version returns to that just pre-Captain Kirk Enterprise. It has a sensibility that is strangely similar and yet expands upon the characters from the original show. And I feel like it has a real love and respect for what was silly and original about that show in the 60s when it came along, while also updating it, making it more diverse and more feminist and more of our time. The special effects are kind of endearingly dorky. There's not a lot of CGI. The aliens seem to basically be done with, you know, puppetry and masks and prosthetics and so forth. And it's just really fun so far. Another thing that I love about it, and this is another of my particular TV quirks, is that it's an episodic show, meaning that each episode stands alone and has that kind of allegorical sci-fi quality that the original show had, you know, where each one would have sort of a theme that it developed and then end, and then the next one starts afresh with a completely new story. So obviously there's some continuity in characters from show to show, but it's not one of those deep mythology shows where it really matters what order you watch the episodes in. So I've just been watching it in a purely playful way. It's my solo show that nobody else in my household watches. And when I'm just in the mood for something that does not demand a lot of you, but that is also not insulting to your intelligence, I watch an episode of Strange New Worlds on Paramount Plus. So that's my endorsement for this week.
That sounds fun. Jamel, what do you got?
I recently picked up the new release of Roland Emmerich's 1992 movie, Universal Soldier. New restored version of it is out, 4K version. So I picked that up and I watched it a couple of days ago, and it's great. I haven't seen it in years, and it's a fun little action movie of the kind they don't really make anymore. The restoration looks terrific. Jean-Claude Van Damme has never looked so crisp. If you've never seen the film, basically the conceit is the U.S. government takes dead soldiers and turns them into sort of like unstoppable killing machines. And one of those soldiers begins to remember its prior humanity, which involves killing and being killed by his former platoon mate in Vietnam, played by Dolph Lundgren, who's also been turned into one of these soldiers and also kind of recovers his humanity such that it is, and they're once again in conflict with each other. It's a very silly conceit. Not every part of the movie is all that strong, but sort of like the action and the fighting is a lot of fun to watch. And this movie spawned a ton of sequels. Most of them are very bad. But about 5 or 6 years ago, there was a sequel that was genuinely fantastic called Universal Soldier Day of Reckoning, which is kind of one of those sort of deconstructing, not just like the mythology, but deconstructing like Van Damme's star persona somewhat and Lundgren's star persona somewhat. So my recommendation or whatnot is going to be to, if you have a chance, to rewatch Universal Soldier. It is good. It's good fun. But also to check out Universal Soldier Day of Reckoning, which I, for my money, is one of the great action flicks of the last decade.
Oh, that's awesome. All right. So I saw something this past weekend that was really almost as mind-blowing, if not as mind-blowing, as the volcano movie, Sublime in surprisingly similar ways. It's a an artwork built out of the earth over in the Catskills in Saugerties, New York, called Opus 40.
I know it. Oh my God, yeah, I love Opus 40. Yes, I want to hear you on it. I know you live right near it, so
it's just shameful that I hadn't made it over there yet, but finally I did, and it's so effectively it's on. I think it's several acres. There's 7 or 10 acres. It may be more, but the artwork itself is basically over 6.5 acres, and it's an earthwork sculpture in the 1930s. A sculptor and a Bard professor named Harvey Feit, F-I-T-E, purchased this old quarry, I guess a bluestone quarry, and then all by himself over 37 years, using only sort of legacy quarrymen tools, like, you know, pre-industrial tools that people who worked on quarries used, he essentially built out of the earth. It began as a sort of gigantic pedestal for his figural statues, which are themselves, I think, quite beautiful. And then he realized, no, in fact, this pedestal is the work in some sense. And it's just intricate masonry. And so it does the exact same thing that the volcano movie does. It conveys a sense of both temporal and spatial scale that extends beyond what appears to be any individual's possible consciousness. And he called it Opus 40 because he knew when he started, he said, this is going to take me 40 years to finish. And in fact, it would have, and he would have finished it, and it would have come in at almost exactly 40, but he fell to his death in the 38th year of doing it while making it. And he basically lived on this property. He was very happily married. His wife was a socialite, Barbara Feit, and they lived together happily as he day after day after day, you know, cut into the earth, shaped these stones, piled them, and turned them into this magnificent, it's hard to describe. There were like sort of semi-subterranean, you know, bluestone alleyways moving up to these, you know, gigantic swirling rock pedestals. It's almost like the freaking Acropolis or something in the middle of the woods. And then there's like a huge monolith. He decided to do something non-figural and as massive as possible at the center of the main pedestal of it. And that's remarkable as well. And that he just wanted to use modern techniques to hoist it and put it in place. And then in the woods on the periphery, there are these quite beautiful, sort of ancient seeming but figural statues that are incredible. But it has the kind of quiet awe of a ruin, right? A site where an entire civilization spent its collective life as a civilization, and that civilization is gone completely, but for the stonework. And this has a feeling of a thing that, regardless of what fucking mischief this species gets up to, this thing is going to be there in 10,000 years. And then you have to permit yourself a chuckle, which is, how are the aliens or future humans, if we're so lucky to have any in 10,000 years, going to completely wildly misinterpret this stone thing? Like, what civilization are they going to extrapolate from this evidence in some sense? It's a remarkable testimony to lonely human obsession and just the desire to create meaning completely in relation to the earth itself, exactly as the movie was. I hadn't seen the movie yet when I went to Opus 40, so it's highly recommended. We'll put a link to the website. Check it out. Dana, I was wondering if you might have ever seen it, but I cannot wait to go back.
Yeah, I mean, I had one very earthy thing to add to your very sublime explanation of what Opus 40 is, which is that it's a really great place to take kids because it's very experiential. We went there when our daughter was probably 6 or something, so about 10 years ago. And it was such a wonderful day because we got to experience all of those things you're talking about and really kind of take it in as a work of art and a, you know, of practice, you know, of a sort of lifelong commitment to this insane project. And meanwhile, she was sort of on this crazy lunar playground where you can climb on rocks and run around through labyrinthine tunnels. And it's a very experiential piece of art. So I really recommend visiting it, even if you have little kids and you think, oh, they're not going to let me look at it. They will, because they'll be enjoying it in their own way.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Jamel, thank you so much for coming back on. That was great.
Always my pleasure.
And Dana, as always, a real pleasure week after week.
It was a joy. I loved our topics this week.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about at our show page. That's slate.com/culturefest. And you can email us at culturefest@slate.com. And of course, we'd like to ask you to subscribe to our podcast at Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts, if you haven't already. Our introductory music is by the composer Nicholas Bertel. Our producer is Cameron Drews. Our production assistants this week are Christy Taiwo Makanjula and Nadira Goff. For Jamel Bowie and Dana Stevens, I'm Stephen Metcalf. Thank you so much for joining us. We will see you soon.